First case for argument this morning, case number 17-1087, Eastern Missouri, Robert Bolden Sr. et al. Versus United States.
Thank you. Ms. Merrigan?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Jennifer Merrigan for appellant Robert Bolden. I will be sharing my time this morning with Carl Micarelli, counsel for amicus, the government of Canada. I have 3 points that I would like to stress today. Number one, the court rested its ruling on contested questions of material fact without first holding a hearing. Two, the court below failed to rule at all on 2 claims before this court. And three, trial counsel were deficient because they made key decisions in ignorance. Specifically, they passed up an opportunity for the Canadian government to advocate for their client without first learning what the consulate could offer, and they jettisoned a mental health mitigation case without first learning the results of the testing that they hired an expert to perform. The standard for denying relief without a hearing is to accept the facts in the light most favorable to Mr. Bolden. In this case, Mr. Bolden proffered clear evidence of brain damage that trial counsel was unaware of because counsel failed to contact their expert to obtain his results. Courts have remanded cases in situations just as this, where counsel ignored evidence of brain damage and the district court denied relief without a hearing. United States versus Runyon in the Fourth Circuit, Fields in the Tenth Circuit, and United States versus Sinisterra in this circuit, where counsel consulted with experts but failed to present any mental health testimony, instead in that case presenting 10 lay witnesses, this court remanded because the record did not affirmatively refute the factual assertions upon which Mr. Sinisterra's claim was based. This court found that without a complete record, it could not determine whether Sinisterra was prejudiced by counsel's alleged failure to investigate and present mitigation evidence, including the testimony of a neuropsychologist, which was presented in 2255. In this case, Mr. Bolden rebutted the strong presumption of reasonableness of trial counsel's actions by proffering affidavits from trial counsel, not wherein they offered subjective arguments about their deficiency, but wherein they admitted factual failures that show that their failure to present the results from Dr. Gurr stemmed from the fact that they, in their words, dropped the ball. They failed to learn of the results from Dr. Gurr, and therefore they forewent a very powerful mental health presentation.
Counsel, how many mental health experts interviewed him or consulted with him, and break down the categories if you need to before trial?
Yes, Your Honor. So this is an area of fact that really underscores the need for a hearing in this case, because the government has pointed to a number of experts that trial counsel requested funding for in 2255, at trial, which records were unsealed in 2255. And so the government has pointed to these experts to show the trial counsel consulted with all of them, when the record is absolutely not clear on that. Trial counsel did consult with Dr. Smith, whose report this court has in front of it, and Dr. Fusatola. And I am going to answer the question, but I want to say that that expert specifically, the neuropsychologist, counsel in its affidavit says they didn't really understand his report. They didn't understand what he was finding, which is why they were seeking brain damage testing. They consulted with Dr. Fisher, who met with Mr. Bolden. He was a positive prison adjustment and future dangerousness expert. That was his sole focus. They also consulted with Dr. Rabin, although it is unclear as to what Dr. Rabin performed in the case. And then the other experts that the government points to, Dr. Tamara Hershey's was a diabetes expert. And then Dan Crane and Dan McMarty were both guilt phase experts. They were DNA and crime scene experts. And then Karen Titelli was the mitigation investigator in the case. So Dr. Ruben Gurr was a licensed, his job in the case, his role in the case was to conduct brain imaging. And he did that. He performed those tests on April 26th and May 7th. And yet counsel simply failed to call him to find out those results. In 2255, when we contacted Dr. Gurr, he was surprised to learn that Mr. Bolden was on death row because he had found significant brain damage, significantly reduced brain volume. He found that Mr. Bolden's brain is actually two standard deviations below the average human brain size, and in some areas, three standard deviations. He noted a highly unusual brain structure. So that was all information that should have been at counsel's fingertips, except that they simply failed to follow up with their expert.
Okay, how many do you, you can divide them into categories, but can you give me a rough number in different categories? How many they consulted, and we know they consulted, how many they, by your view, they consulted and didn't know, or, you know?
Yes, Your Honor. So they consulted, by my count, they consulted two psychiatrists, although we only know that one of those saw Mr. Bolden. They consulted a future dangerousness expert, and then they consulted a neuropsychologist who actually saw Mr. Bolden. And he is the person that in his report said that he saw indications of brain damage. But counsel...
Now, of those four or five, how many included references to aggressive and impulsive behavior?
So in their reports, Dr. Smith specifically refers to aggressive and impulsive behavior. Dr. Fusatola does not. He discusses impulsive behavior that went to planning in the moment. And Dr. Gurr also talks about impulsivity with regards to planning and difficulty in processing information. And all three of them, and Dr. Dudley, who we brought on in 2255, discuss the fact that the brain damage that Mr. Bolden exhibited, the significant brain damage, really went to his ability to process and plan in the moment. This is precisely the kind of evidence that the Supreme Court talked about in Williams versus Taylor, when it talked about a violent behavior as a compulsive reaction rather than the product of cold-blooded premeditation. And that is why this evidence would have been so important for counsel in this case, because the government repeatedly emphasized two aggravating factors. And those were that the murder was committed for pecuniary gain and that it was committed in order to evade detection. In closing arguments, counsel for the government emphasized these over a dozen times and repeatedly told the jury that because none of the mitigation was linked to or connected to those that premeditation and that planning, that the jury should disregard it. In fact, counsel should have had in their arsenal evidence that was directly linked to that ability to plan, especially in the moment. In this case, the verdict forms showed that there was one mental health mitigator, and that mitigator misstated the evidence. It instructed the jury that Mr. Bolden's mental and emotional disturbances, while not severe, impacted his behavior. Counsel introduced that mitigator because it had failed to follow up with their expert. Had they followed up with him, they would have known that, in fact, it was severe. In this case, the district court failed in many respects to apply the proper Sanders analysis. It refers to the brain damage evidence as purported. It refers to any link with Mr. Bolden's behavior as sheer speculation. In fact, it should have credited those facts as true. Mr. Bolden proffered them in evidence to the court, evidence that went unrebutted because the government did not introduce the report of its expert, Dr. Wetzel. In fact, trial counsel never saw that report when it made the unreasonably uninformed decision to forego mitigation of brain damage in this case. Our experts also found significant trauma, which worked, they said, synergistically with the brain damage in this case. Additionally, trial counsel failed when it knew that their client was born in Canada, but failed to contact the Canadian government. Counsel admit in affidavits that they knew they had just attended a conference and they knew that it was their responsibility to contact a foreign government when they were representing a foreign national. They obtained Mr. Bolden's birth certificate, and then they failed to contact Canada without ever having learned how Canada could have assisted. And in this case, this was a federal case. It had to undergo capital case authorization at the Department of Justice. And the DOJ manuals and United States Attorney's manuals located in our appendix all instruct that the government must consider the foreign citizenship status. Canada, in an affidavit that we supplied from the director of the consular, of the Canadian consulate at that time, provides that Canada would have intervened and that they have intervened successfully pre-trial in two other cases in the United States, but they weren't given that opportunity. Here, the harm is that a foreign ally was not at the negotiating table.
Are you talking assistance at the guilt phase or the penalty phase?
Your Honor, I'm actually talking about assistance pre-trial when the Department of Justice was making an executive decision to prosecute this case capitally.
I thought that decision triggered the notification requirement.
No, Your Honor. When the government arrested Mr. Bolden, they were aware that he was Canadian, and several documents from the marshals reflected that he was Canadian. But actually, this claim does not stem from a notification requirement of the Vienna Convention. This claim stems from trial counsel's duties to have availed themselves of the resources that the Canadian government could have offered, but failed to do so. This claim additionally was not ruled on by the lower court. It did not rule on either the Strickland deficiency prong or the prejudice prong under this claim.
How would we predict whether the Attorney General would have been influenced by anything the Canadians might have? Well, first of all, how do we know what the Canadians would have said? I guess your position there would be we could predict they would have registered some opposition to capital punishment, but how do we predict whether the Attorney General would have been influenced by that?
Well, Your Honor, I think it is a question of a dispute of material facts, and I think it warrants a hearing. We proffered evidence that Canada has been successful at the negotiating table in capital cases, in two highly aggravated capital cases.
What did you present regarding this particular case at the relevant moment in time?
Yes, Your Honor. We provided an affidavit from the director of the consular services in 2002 when Mr. Bolden was arrested and at the time of his authorization, who stated that he would have sat down at the negotiating table, that he has had success in capital cases previously. And he provided a list of capital cases in the United States and abroad where Canada has successfully negotiated the death penalty off the table.
And what did he say what his position would have been with respect to Mr. Bolden, who hadn't been in Canada since he was 16 months old?
The Canadian government maintains that Mr. Bolden is a Canadian citizen and that he would have the force of their advocacy, Your Honor. And we provided two separate affidavits.
But that's not case specific.
Well, it's It is provided in this case that they would provide that for Mr. Bolden, Your Honor. And those affidavits are in our appendix as well.
What kind of hearing would you recommend or urge regarding what the Attorney General of the United States would have done, though? I don't understand how we would have a factual proceeding as to whether there's a reasonable probability that the Attorney General would have declined to proceed.
Your Honor, we would call witnesses that are involved in the capital case authorization process and that were at that time. We would also present evidence regarding other foreign nationals and cases that have been deauthorized by the federal government or not authorized where they involved foreign intervention. And we would be able to compare the aggravation and circumstances in those cases and the measures taken by those federal governments, by those foreign governments.
When you say people who were involved in the authorization process at the time, are you referring to officials of the U.S. Department of Justice?
Yes, Your Honor. Officials of the U.S. Department of Justice. I'm also referring to others involved in the process. So, for example, we would use the court subpoena power to call and examine members of the capital case authorization committee.
Who are officials of the U.S. Department of Justice, is that right?
That's correct, or former at the time.
So you would try to compel people from the Justice Department at the time to come forward and give a view about what they would have done if the Canadians had weighed in on the matter?
Your Honor, yes, and we would present evidence from other attorneys that were involved in the cases of other foreign nationals that the United States attorney did not seek death on.
I understood you would try to bring in other cases and argue this is analogous, but I'm trying to understand whether you would try to recreate the authorization process in the Bolden case. It sounds like you would try to do that from what you're saying, that you're going to call these former U.S. officials and ask them to hypothesize what they would have done.
Your Honor, at this point, meeting the burden of a reasonable probability of a different outcome, I don't think that it requires that level.
What case supports the admissibility of that kind of testimony?
In a 2255 hearing, I will need to think about that, Your Honor, and I will respond to that on rebuttal. I would like to cede 6 minutes of my time to Mr. Micarelli, who is representing the Government of Canada.
Mr. Micarelli?
Yes, thank you, Your Honors. I'm Carl Micarelli of Debevoise and Plimpton, and I represent the Government of Canada. I want to pick up on what Ms. Merrigan was just talking about Canada's participation in the capital review process. There are three reasons, actually, why we believe this could have made a difference. First of all, as Ms. Merrigan already pointed out, the U.S. Attorney's Manual required prosecutors to specifically include a discussion on whether defendants are citizens of foreign countries, and if so, whether the requirements of the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations have been satisfied. That's page AP 363 of the appendix. Excuse me. This makes clear that the foreign relations implications of seeking the death penalty are something the Justice Department takes into consideration, and so is the opportunity for foreign consular officials to assist the defendant. If they weren't concerned about that, they wouldn't have asked for that. They wouldn't have made that a mandatory piece of information to include. Second, Canada's own experience demonstrates, as Ms. Merrigan also pointed out, that its participation can factor into a prosecutor's decision. In particular, one good example of this.
I want to get case specific. It seems to me in this situation, the Canadian officials would have had little to say other than we oppose the death penalty.
We would have had that to say. We would have.
And that was not you. That obviously was not universally successful. Maybe you can point to one or two where it was, but well, I'll bet those were case specific.
The case where it wasn't successful was a case out of the Texas state court system, the Folder case, where there
wait,
was.
Wait, don't get distracted. I want to know what they would have said, other than we oppose the death penalty, to in terms of assistance provided to someone who'd not been in Canada since he was an infant.
Well, we could have helped bring to bear information about his childhood in Canada, which was a piece of the mitigation case that the government.
All right, what's in the this evidentiary hearing? What's showing? Has been made regarding the specifics of that.
Well, Your Honor, that's a question of strategy for Ms. Merrigan. I mean, obviously, what would be put on?
Your client would have had to provide the ammunition, so to speak. What did you provide?
Yes, Your Honor, we have information about Mr. Bolden's childhood in Canada that trial counsel did not have. Ms. Merrigan was able to get that.
When was that information gathered?
After 2010, after the conviction and death sentence, only after we learned about Mr. Bolden's conviction and death sentence. We were not aware of this before trial. We were not aware of this case before trial. And you know, just as to the question of whether the U.S. would be concerned about this thing, again, I want to get back to the Folder case. That was the one case where there was an execution in the U.S. despite opposition by Canada. That was a case of the Texas state courts where we didn't learn about it until after the death sentence. In that case, something really remarkable happened. The Secretary of State, probably the first time in history, wrote to the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles saying that there should have been that they should hold off on the execution.
Refresh me, I saw it in your briefs, but refresh me, what was the date of that the Secretary of State wrote to Texas?
That was Secretary Albright, but that was not the last.
That's a good enough date for me. Now in this case, I assume the Attorney General himself at this time we're dealing with the Attorney General himself's decision in 2003, right?
That's right.
Okay. And what kind of showing could you make that would have made a difference to the Attorney General in 2003?
Well, I think a couple things. First of all, President George Bush in the Medellin case wrote a memo to the Attorney General saying that the United States should hold off on executions of Mexican nationals affected by the Avena case until they had an opportunity for review and reconsideration, and that indicates that, you know, in those days too, the United States was concerned about what foreign countries had to think about execution of their nationals. And I'm sorry, I've cut into Ms. Merrigan's rebuttal time. I could wrap up or I could keep talking up to the court, but I think I will cede the rest of my time to Ms. Merrigan for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Riley?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Mike Riley. I'm appearing today as an assistant U.S. attorney from the Eastern District of Missouri. I was co-counsel on this case and one of the lawyers who tried the case in 2006, Steve Holzhauser, the lead counsel on the case, now in private practice. And collectively, Your Honors, I know this is a huge record and it may appear complicated, but when the court applies the standards that guide 2255 claims, there are multiple straightforward reasons why each claim fails in this case. And, Your Honor, with regard to the mitigation investigation, here we had exceedingly experienced counsel who had 3.5 years to conduct a large-scale mitigation investigation, which the records before us indicate they consulted multiple mental health professionals. The United States presented in this case a powerful aggravation case, and that's relevant just to the weight of the aggravation case, and the defense submitted 32 mitigators to the jury. Counsel did develop and litigate mental health expert, and based on the record at trial, they chose to present evidence through lay witnesses, including a nurse who was a family member of Mr. Bolden, and they also presented evidence that was tailored to meet this extremely powerful mitigation case, which included Mr. Bolden's downward spiral, his positive traits, and his sincere remorse for this heinous crime. None of the alleged errors or proffered evidence would change the overwhelming evidence or the weight of the aggravators in this case that would affect the ultimate weighing process in the case sufficient to justify, which was substantial. The aggravating factors were sufficient to outweigh the mitigating factors to justify a sentence of death consistent with the district court instruction 435, instruction number 9. There was no Brady violation in terms of the actual, I'm just going to touch on those INS records for a moment. Those were records that were known to Mr. Bolden. They were not material.
Counsel, before you go too far, the district court didn't say anything about them in the order, right? I mean, not a word. Acknowledged the amended 2255, but then didn't say anything at all, not a word about them, right?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I reviewed the order, and I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
How can you talk about any facts if we don't have any facts?
Well, they've been placed before the court, Your Honor, in the record, and what?
Well, now wait, hold on. The record on appeal is the record in the district court, right? It's a federal appellate procedure. So tell me what you mean by record.
The record would include it is the record of the district court, Your Honor. That's absolutely correct. But counsel had submitted the records to the court for its consideration, and my suggestion is in conducting de novo review, those records were part of the record in the case, and the records either contradict the mitigation themes or they're cumulative or remote. I'd also say we pointed out at page 81 of our brief that Mr. Bolden vastly overstates what's contained in the record when he states that they would show that Stella Decker left Canada to escape racism, poverty, and abuse. In any event...
Well, let me interrupt you again. Yeah, I realize the general standard's de novo, but it seems to me that in this kind of case, what about a limited remand to the district court for them to make some findings of fact on this?
Your Honor, that certainly would be a possibility, Your Honor. I also believe the court could make a ruling based on the record before it, and perhaps while the court didn't address it explicitly in the order, I think at best it's an implicit ruling. She did consider their claims. I understand. I do not see it in the order, Your Honor, but I do think there's still a basis to make a ruling. The other thing I'd just touch on that, Your Honor.
Before you go further on that question about the Brady claim, as I understand it, there were no factual findings in this order at all, right? Because the judge said there was no need for a hearing.
That's correct. The judge said there was no need for a hearing, and based on the record before us, Your Honor, on all the claims, the government stands by that. Based on the totality of the record as outlined in the government's briefing, there was no need for a hearing.
So on the Brady claim, your position would be the court can just look at the materials that were allegedly not disclosed and make a legal determination.
Absolutely.
That either they were not material or they were available to the defense or one of your other arguments.
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. That's absolutely correct, Judge Carlton.
Ms. Merrigan didn't argue this Brady claim. You seem to want to argue the Brady claim, but why don't you talk about the brain evidence? That was the lead argument of the appellant here, if you would,
yes,
and address why that doesn't call for a hearing.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. Judge, looking at the record as a whole and being guided by the Strickland analysis in this case, did counsel make errors so serious that counsel was not functioning as counsel as guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment? And keeping in mind also, even the best criminal defense attorneys would not defend a particular client the same way. Here, when we look at the scope of the investigation, we're certainly not confronted with anything akin to some of the cases that we've seen, like Wiggins versus Smith or Rompilla versus Beard. And we've laid it out in the brief, Your Honor, but the mitigation investigation in this case, experienced capital counsel employed an experienced mitigation specialist who worked on 85 death penalty cases, and their pleadings indicate they were fully aware that they needed to develop a history, including Mr. Bolden's medical background, and it's all funneled toward expert testimony potentially. The mitigation expert spent 10 months, interviewed 33 witnesses, reviewed 2,500 pages of record, and then filed a pleading with the court that said, after 10 months and a $30,000 something bill with the scope of that investigation, that she now understood what she needed to do and she would need 500 more hours to complete the investigation. So the investigation is massive in its scope, and moving toward the actual mental health evidence, it's clear that counsel did consult with mental health professionals, including Robert Smith, a PhD in clinical psychologist and certified specialist. And I note for the record, it's cited in our brief, but the breadth of the material that's contained at AP 112 to 120 that was reviewed by Dr. Smith is significant. That's the product of this massive mitigation investigation by skilled counsel. They also consulted with Dr. Fusatola, a board-certified neuropsychologist and assistant professor of neurology at Washington University. And as counsel has conceded, they consulted with John Rabin, who's, I believe, his affidavit at government's appendix 143 and 144 states that he twice examined Mr. Bolden in 2005. And like Dr. Dudley, Dr. Rabin is a psychiatrist. He's a medical doctor and a forensic psychiatrist. So it appears that Mr. Bolden was presented twice to a qualified psychiatrist. So prior to trial, we have him being examined by a clinical psychologist with Dr. Smith, Dr. Fusatola, a certified neuropsychologist, and Dr. Rabin, a psychiatrist. And I understand Dr. Gurr conducted the PET scans. He was hired by counsel in February of 2006 and conducted an MRI and PET scan in March and April, respectively, in 2006. The pleadings suggest that counsel was fully aware in their pleadings petitioning regarding Dr. Ryan and Dr. Hershey that there could be organic brain damage issues. This was something that they considered. The record before us reflects, however, that counsel made a clear strategic choice. And what I would also refer the court to, I laid out in the brief itself the factors that support this appears. When we look at it from an objective point of view from Strickland, the record appears that counsel, after having conducted a constitutionally reasonable investigation, that counsel made a strategic choice to go the other way. And the record would indicate that certainly afforded counsel the benefits of presenting the evidence through a family member who counsel pointed out was on her way, an aspiring doctor. She was familiar with depression. She was familiar with diabetes. And incidentally, she testified to the downward spiral that's very consistent with what was described in Dr. Smith's report. Her testimony was significantly similar to that.
Was that a family member? Who was that witness?
It was a family member. Her name was Sandra Stidham, and she was a nurse. And if you'll indulge me for just a brief moment, her testimony was essentially, as far as depression, when it was worse, his medical condition declined. The more depressed he was, the sicker he got. When his depression level was high, then his episodes with diabetes, they were more. It happened more as far as the sugar levels. You know, him being hyper and hypoglycemic, then passing out, sweating, the drug usage was way worse. His overall appearance and everything was gone down. Not working, everything was gone down. That's at AP 2016 and 17. And they also called a former girlfriend or friend of Mr. Bolden who kind of reinforced or buttressed that he was down in the dumps, depressed, and really did not care about anything. So they presented the evidence, and it afforded strategic advantages. But what I'd like to do is, again, just touch on our 924J letter in the Chandler case. This is an objective assessment. So even though counsel submitted affidavits, there were multiple ways to defend this case, and they certainly chose one of the reasonable paths. And that's the inquiry here. Not could they have done it a different way? Perhaps they could have. As the cases indicate, no lawyer may defend a case the same way two times, or a different lawyer may defend it differently. And that's laid out in the footnote in Chandler, footnote 16 and 17. But if I can touch on prejudice.
Before you go to prejudice, when you say it's an objective question, do you mean reasonableness of counsel's performance is an objective question?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. That's for the court.
Whether counsel made a strategic decision, isn't that a matter on which factual inquiry is sometimes warranted?
Sometimes, perhaps, Your Honor, but I think in view of the overall record in this case, and I know this was something the court considered in Paul and Allen, but the objective test for the performance, as long as counsel would have performed as a competent lawyer would, his or her detailed subjective reasoning is beside the point. And I'd step back and put it at the broader performance in this case, where the record indicates counsel chose an alternative path. And if I may, the proffered evidence would not have, for one thing, it would have undercut the significant evidence of remorse that was critical in this case with a nasty crime. And I'm just going to touch on the predictive weighing analysis just for a moment. It helps us segue into prejudice, which there's none. But it would have undercut, is Mr. Bolden capable of meaning conversion? He had an outstanding performance in Bible school and he accepts responsibility, or he's so brain damaged that he's incapable of meaning conversion. And when we look at the nature of the crime itself, so there's some strategic concerns. There's additional strategic concerns outlined in the brief. But when we look at where would we end up if this evidence was presented or we had a hearing in the exact same place because of the strength of the aggravation case, the nature of the crime, the devastation to the lay family, including what would be, again, if I may pause just briefly to touch on the weight of the case, ironclad guilt with identification, DNA evidence, a step back after a shot to the jaw that's causing him to drown in his own blood. He steps back and shoots him in the head. Linda Lay's primary, when she testified, one of her most important things in her life was being a mother and a grandmother. She was deprived of both of those. Cliff Waddy testified. He arrived at the scene. He held Nathan Lay's hand as he was dying. He had flashbacks to the smell of Nathan Lay's blood, and Tom Lay, the father, had to walk into the hospital and see his son hooked up on tubes and unresponsive. And so this is from a man who's 38 years old with a criminal history. That's a powerful aggravation case. So when we look at the predictive weighing analysis and we look at Mr. Bolden's functional ability when he committed the crime, in terms of his ability to plan the crime, and he made a decision at the time, and that's in the record, it was either kill the guard or shoot the guard or spend the rest of my life in prison, something to that effect. And then he went back to his residence and took steps to cover up the crime. So we've got evidence of functionality with the commission of the crime. We have educational records that don't reflect brain damage, but an average IQ. He did reasonably well in school. There's record evidence of that. Moreover, there's also evidence of his remarkable jail Bible correspondence, which the defense presented in their case. And finally, if we look at his additional jail correspondence, review the correspondence, there's nothing that is indicative of brain damage in what Mr. Bolden articulates in his written grievances. So when we look at the predictive weighing analysis, one thing, it would have undercut mitigation. It would have opened the door to rebuttal testimony, and it would have also, in Dr. Smith's notes, had they started to present this type of evidence, we also would have gotten to the fact that Dr. Smith had some positive findings about Mr. Mr. Bolden, but more significantly, he had some positive findings in terms of his mental abilities in the original report. But more significantly, what we would have gotten into was that Mr. Bolden sold drugs for a period of 4 years when he wasn't using drugs. That was in Dr. Smith's notes. And the defense argument, part of the argument that Mr. McGraw, now Judge McGraw, made to the jury was that Robert Bolden was only a he was only 3% of his life was he involved in criminal activity. And it allowed the defense to limit and make his conduct appear to be more of an aberration. They would have blown out by 4 years the period in which Mr. Bolden sold drugs and greatly expanded his prior criminal activity. So then in addition to that, we potentially would have got into at least potentially another shooting that was included in the death penalty notices in this case, the, where he shot another man in the face. And in the appendix, I think it, the sealed government's appendix, it, I believe it's 169, there's a factual basis. The shotgun was fired first. That's what the young man was shot with. And then there were shots that were not so loud after that. That's consistent with Mr. Bolden having fired the first shot. Counsel argued that Mr. Bolden had never been involved in violent crime before. That was also part of the argument. So where counsel wanted to present a mitigating case to the jury that here's an individual who's never been involved in violent crime, criminalized prior criminal activity only spans 3% of his life, and then counsel wanted to touch on, develop the downward spiral, depression, and the confluence of events, drug usage that caused Mr. Bolden, that would explain this heinous crime, that was the chosen path in this case. And frankly, when we look at the findings that the jury made, I disagree with counsel's characterization of the finding regarding mental health evidence or the impairments that Mr. Bolden had. They did present evidence of that, and the jury didn't find it compelling. What the jury found compelling, where we have findings of eight people finding mitigating circumstances, is consistent with what the case that counsel presented, which is evidence of a reasonable performance. And they were on the right track in terms of remorse, his diabetes, the things that mattered to the jury, those were in his relationship with his children, which they emphasized. But back to prejudice. Again, in the face of the mitigation case, strike that, in the face of the aggravation case and the evidence of Bolden's level of functioning, this evidence would not have made any difference in the predictive weighing analysis. When we look at the instruction in the case, even if the evidence may have changed something, which I don't concede it does, none of the alleged errors or proffered evidence would change the overwhelming weight of the aggravating factors. There's nothing that would change the ultimate outcome in the weighing process. And Judge Jackson did watch this trial. She sat in, she saw the evidence, and the aggravating factors were sufficient to outweigh any mitigating factors to justify a sentence of death. If even considering this evidence, Mr. Bolden would still get the death penalty, even if we consider the proffers, for all the reasons that we've stated. If I may, Your Honor, if I may move to the Vienna Convention claim, unless the court has additional questions on that point. With regard to the Vienna Convention claim, as an initial matter, the point is procedurally defaulted, and that's a significant point. It could have been raised on direct appeal, and it was not. Moreover, I note it sounds like counsel may have conceded that the Vienna Convention claim is limited to ineffective assistance of counsel, not notification, if I'm not mistaken. But in any event...
Counsel, is ineffective assistance of appellate counsel also argued, or just trial counsel? Just the focus seems to be on trial counsel.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the first time that I had seen the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, our position is that the certificate of appealability did not cover appellate counsel. And the first time I believe we see it, there's a lot of briefing here, but if I'm not mistaken, I think the first time we saw it was in the reply brief, Your Honor. But nonetheless, the claim is procedurally barred. Mr. Bolden could have raised his Vienna Convention on direct appeal, and he did not. Therefore, the court cannot consider the claim unless Mr. Bolden establishes cause for failing to raise the claim on direct appeal. And for cause, Mr. Bolden now claims that his appellate attorney was ineffective for failing to raise the claim on direct appeal. Again, we don't concede that that's within the certificate of appealability, but he cannot establish that his appellate counsel was ineffective for failing to raise this claim on direct appeal. Even if he could establish that his appellate counsel failed to raise this on direct appeal, it does not rise to the level of constitutionally infirm representation. That is, he cannot establish that his appellate attorney raised this issue on direct appeal, that if he had, the outcome of the appellate proceedings would have been different, meaning that Bolden would have prevailed on direct appeal. In order for that to happen, Mr. Bolden would have to show that had the Canadian counsel had been informed of his prosecution, they would have been able to have provide some level of appreciable assistance in this case that would have affected his conviction and sentence and his behavior in his favor. They simply would not have been able to provide that assistance. And the fact of the matter is that all the way that Canada insisted may be able to help either doesn't apply here, or in the case of its contact with the Department of Justice and the pre-authorization process is purely rank speculation. So let's talk about it.
Let me ask you this, counsel, maybe a distraction. In the case as it was tried, how much was the jury told about the illegal alien status?
Not at all, Your Honor. That's an interesting point that you raised, Judge, because...
Well, that's a strategic point. If that was kept from the jury, that to me has quite a significant impact on why the Canadian background was not probed.
Well, that's absolutely right. And that goes to potential damaging evidence, and it goes to the notification claim, it goes to the INS records. Mr. Bolden's status as being here illegally and being deportable is not a factor that favors the defendant when he shoots a fine young bank guard in the head two times. There are potential strategic reasons why the defense who knew Bolden was born in Canada, there are potential reasons why the defense may not have gone into that. Now, and I would like to touch on something for the record.
What about the authorization process? That wouldn't have involved any presentation of information to the jury. And Ms. Merrigan says she wants a hearing at which she would call, you know, various people who are involved in supposedly analogous cases involving foreign nationals where the death penalty was not sought after advocacy by foreign governments, and apparently would try to summon members of the committee to discuss whether they would have been influenced by concerns of foreign relations, which she says is mentioned in the U.S. Attorney's Manual. So could you address that whole matter?
Yes, Your Honor. First, with regard to the U.S. Attorney, well, if I can move into the facts for a moment, Your Honor, I concede that Mr. Bolden wasn't notified, or Mr. Bolden did not request consular notification, nor did the government notify him of those rights. But the way Mr. Bolden presented, he did not present as a Canadian citizen. And I also, as we pointed out in our 28J letter, we were in possession of materials that he had been arrested and strike that been born in Canada. Those were contained in his education materials. But the case was initially charged at the state level. Adopted, it was indicted sometime in November. The crime occurred in October, and the defendant was written into custody. Those are contained in the early docket entries of the case. So he was arrested by local authorities initially, and everything about Mr. Bolden, at least at the initial outset, he presented as an American citizen in terms of his, there was no language barrier, there was no as far as we could see, he had a domestic background in St. Louis and a criminal history of being through the justice system. But in terms of some of the concerns that you've raised, Your Honor, to address the nature of the evidentiary hearing or the proposed evidentiary hearing, ultimately, we take the position this would never have tipped the scales because of Mr. Bolden's exceedingly tenuous connection to Canada. The government of Canada did not succeed in the Falder case where the connection to Canada was much stronger than it was here. Mr. Bolden, having spent 16 months in Canada, has an extremely tenuous connection. And then the speculative nature of the hearing that counsel proposes would contain the oddity of compelling executive branch officials to testify to what they would have done.
Well, it's only odd because you didn't go through the proper notification process that would have triggered that inquiry at the relevant time. So maybe it's an oddity, but could she do it? And is there a reason, you know, is there a potential that Justice Department people would be affected by the Canadian government in a way that the state of Texas would not be?
Judge, one thing I point out to this point, the Canadian government has not intervened other than the filing of its brief. And I think the cases, including the Sixth Circuit case that we've cited in our brief, these are matters for the State Department potentially. But again, with the VCCR does not impose individual rights. It doesn't rise to the level of a constitutional claim. We've outlined this in our brief. And in terms of the Department of Justice manual, by no means, the notification wasn't made in this case. And the reason is he did not present as a Canadian citizen. Having said that, I don't intend to sound cavalier one bit about the fact that he wasn't notified, but the VCCR does not impose or confer individual rights. And in terms of the Department of Justice manual, the Department of Justice manual does mandate procedures, but again, that does not confer substantive rights. And now we're getting into a situation where we're considering having one branch of the government compel the executive branch to comply with its procedures, which we didn't in this case. But for the reasons that I've stated, and again, at the end of the day, like all the claims in this case, none of these are outcome determinative. This essentially is rank speculation. Mr. Bolden spent his childhood in Canada. The evidence is remote and tenuous in terms of what Canada could have offered. That might be useful if Mr. Bolden's mother was charged with a murder in terms of her background, but not necessarily Mr. Bolden. None of this would have tipped the scales, and there's no reason in view of Mr. Bolden's background, where he essentially presents and acts as an American citizen familiar with the legal system, to suspect that the Department of Justice would have changed the recommendation in this case based on the grievous nature of the crime.
There was a reference in the briefs to a sister who testified as a mitigating witness. Was that his mother's sister?
No, Your Honor. It was another family member, and I'd have to look at my notes. It might have been a cousin.
Was it a Canadian family member?
No, Your Honor. It was a Canada member of the family. From her name was Sandra Stidham, and she was a family member from St. Louis, and she testified to his childhood. I believe, without looking at my notes, the abusive background. She claimed the background of the Clarks is essentially adopted family was an abusive one, but the INS records reflect differently. But she also testified to evidence of Mr. Bolden's abandonment, that Stella Clark was an alcoholic and a drunk. And she put on evidence of his childhood that was much more significant than
well, all right, but my point is on was it. Is back to what the jury was not told about his background. But did any Canadian citizen testify in the mitigation case?
No, Your Honor, not at
was,
all.
Was there any reference to his mother being Canadian?
No, Your Honor, not that I recall. And again, Your Honor, our position is, of course, that evidence is remote and tenuous and would never tip the balance in a predictive weighing analysis. The last thing I would touch on is that Counsel here, Mr. McGraw, was involved in over 30 state death penalty cases. Mr. Curran is on the Eighth Circuit's instruction committee for death penalty cases. He's the first assistant in the public defender's office. These are exceedingly experienced counsel. And I look at their affidavits, and perhaps they owe a duty of loyalty to their client, and they also may be viewing the distorting effects of hindsight. But when we look at the record in this case, it's exceedingly deliberate at every level. These were expert capital counsel with a well-resourced investigation. And with that, unless there are further questions, I'd simply ask the court to affirm and find that there's no basis for relief on any of the claims that Mr. Bolden has presented. No basis for an evidentiary hearing based on this record, or no relief.
Very good. Ms. Merrigan for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. I would like to start with the Brady claim. As this court pointed out, the lower court did not make any findings of fact or even discuss that claim, though it did grant appellant leave to amend and file that claim when we received the records from the government in 2255. Yesterday, the government...
Now, before you leave that, so you would say take your facts as alleged, right? And make a decision, because this is de novo, right?
Your Honor, what I would say is that there should be a remand for a hearing because there's material disputes.
No, wait. We're talking about different kinds of hearings. The statute talks about an evidentiary hearing, and I don't want to take your time. I thought this was a clear point, that by the statute and by all our cases, we take the facts as alleged as true and then determine if you get an evidentiary hearing, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And under 2255B, I do think we're entitled to an evidentiary hearing on this claim.
Yeah, but in the absence of the evidentiary hearing, we just assume you're the facts alleged are true on this claim, right?
That's correct.
Proceed.
Yesterday, the government admitted that they did know that he was Canadian and that they had those records in his file. For 10 years of pleadings, the government has maintained they did not know he was Canadian. And the court should consider that when considering the actual possession of these records. Number two, I would like to respond to a few things that counsel discussed with regard to the brain damage. Counsel is correct that Judge McGraw has a lot of experience in capital cases, and that is why he and Kevin Curran both submitted affidavits admitting that they dropped the ball with regards to getting the brain damage information. They both admit that brain damage was their primary strategy in this case, and they didn't have evidence of it, and it was because they failed to call their expert. That is what the evidence bears out. Here, that was deficient because no reasonable trial counsel would spend that kind of funds and energy and time to obtain that kind of testing and then fail to call their expert. That is deficient. Additionally, in this case, Dr. Gurr admits in his affidavit he never heard from trial counsel after that. In this case, The government's argument that counsel strategically put on a nurse, this court should look very skeptically at that. The cousin that he's talking about was a graduate nurse who had been out of school for 9 months, according to her testimony. She worked at a veteran's home. She was not a licensed nurse or even a registered nurse. And for Mr. Riley to call her an aspiring doctor is disingenuous. And it is another example of the way that the facts in this case are being interpreted in the light least favorable to Mr. Bolden. And that is not the standard. That is not where we're at. I would also like to clarify that we are raising two claims under the Vienna Convention claim. These relate to constitutional violations that stemmed from the failure to comply with the Vienna Convention. The first is that trial counsel were ineffective. That is not defaulted. And the second, that the government, that there was a procedural due process violation, we alleged cause. We alleged that that was because appellate counsel was ineffective. And we alleged it in our papers below. The Brady claim and the first aspect of the Vienna Convention claim, that trial counsel were ineffective for failing to comply with their duties under the convention.
Is there an affidavit from appellate counsel on this question?
Your Honor, I believe that there is. Can you check Hemingway? I believe that there is, and will...
Is this another drop the ball affidavit or what?
My colleague is pulling that up for me. I also would like to offer, in regards to Judge Loken's question during my opening, under TUI, there are multiple cases in which evidence obtained pursuant to court order was court-ordered TUI process was presented to 2255 court. And some of those cases are Martin versus United States in the Southern District of West Virginia, Greeno versus United States in the Eastern District of North Carolina, and we will be glad to provide a 28-J letter with these.
Please.
Additionally, with regards to the mention of Canada at the trial count at the trial court level, Judge McGraw opened his opening arguments to the jury by saying that Stella Decker was from Canada. So he did insert that Robert and his mother were from Canada into the record, but then they failed to call a single witness to that effect.
Well, I thought you said he brought up that the mother was from Canada, and then you said he did insert that Robert was from Canada. That doesn't follow.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you for clarifying that. And
well, I'm not clarifying it. I'm asking whether what you just said is incorrect.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you for asking that question, and I'm looking that up right now.
What about on this question of whether the committee should have considered his Canadian status and so forth? I still don't understand how we would reconstruct what the government would have done all these years ago. Couldn't the current president just decide if there's some foreign relations problem here and make a decision about whether to grant clemency or something? Why isn't that a better avenue than trying to speculate about what the U.S. government would have done 20-some years ago?
Well, Your Honor, the government has two separate processes, and there's a pre-authorization process by which its own protocols require it to consider the foreign national status. And then there is a commutation and clemency process, which specifically provides that that the petitioner should not be involved in judicial proceedings. So Mr. Bolden presently is raising a claim under that failure to notify Canada and involve them in the pretrial process. Whether or not he involves Canada, and Canada has been very involved in this case, for post-judicial clemency processes remains to be seen because we're not there yet. But it does not do away with the requirement or with what Canada would have done pre-trial. And to clarify my earlier point, what Judge McGraw told the jury in opening is that both Stella Decker and Robert Bolden came from Canada to St. Louis. And I see that I am at time. So thank you very much.
Very good. Counsel, the case has been very thoroughly briefed and well argued, and we will take it under advisement. Please call the next case.
Case number 20-2771, Western Missouri, Jill Denise Olson versus Lee Krause Jr.